Okay, so welcome back, everyone. And we're going to start with some practice and then once again have a chance to talk and then do more practice, and then it will be time for lunch. We may have some people joining today that weren't here yesterday. And those of you that are joining today that weren't here yesterday, some of you may be familiar with my current way of doing noting, the see, hear, feel with, quote, flexible labeling, where the words, we just need the three words, see, hear, feel, to cover any kind of experience. If you're pretty familiar with that, if you know what it means, if I say, okay, now we're going to do see, hear, feel, unrestricted, focus on everything. Now we're going to just do visual. Now we're going to do auditory. Now we're going to do somatic. Now let's choose which of those four you want. If you totally understand what that means, then great. If you don't, we're going to give you an opportunity to have some private lesson with Janusz in that room over there. Also, any of you who were here yesterday but would like some pointers or a little more precision about how to do those four focus ranges, you can join that also. So I don't know if we'll have a lot of people that want to do that, or you know, one or two or whatever, but what we're going to do is, in a minute, I'll start guidance here for the main group. Anyone that would like to sort of have a TA session with one of my very strong facilitators, Janusz, here, you can go into that that room over there, whatever that's called officially. The small classroom, we're going to close both of these doors, so there won't hopefully won't be any acoustic leaking, but if there is, hey, that's just here. You know, they got the other sounds from out there. So anyway, how many people would like to join that little TA session? We'll see. Got one, two, maybe got two or three. This way we like everyone to, you know, be satisfied customers and come away confident that they know how to implement the procedures. So those of you that want to do that, you can now get up and go to that room. Janusz will answer your questions and give you guidance and so forth. And then the rest of us will do what we learned how to do yesterday. Take a moment to stretch up and settle in. Enjoy the stillness of the body, the stillness that comes through really accepting the way the body feels moment by moment. The erectness of the spine maintained through alignment and balance rather than effort. The erectness of the spine wakes up the central nervous system and fosters sensory clarity. The repose of the body, everything hanging limp and loose from that central pillar, opens the body, which then opens consciousness, fostering equanimity, the ability to allow sensory experiences to come and go without push and pull. one of the great discoveries of the East. Body posture influences consciousness, citta. Our first focus range for just a few minutes will be unrestricted. See, hear, feel everything, as you'll recall. At any given instant, you will be focusing on one sensory modality. And we're taking a passive contact stance, meaning just let sensory experiences come or call. If two or three modalities come or call at the same time, just choose one to acknowledge and then briefly focus on. If nothing much seems to be happening, restful states are happening. The mental screen is blank. There's darkness, brightness behind your eyelids. Your body is relaxed. Mental talk space has gone quiet. You're seeing rest, hearing rest, feeling rest. Note them in terms of the corresponding modality. And that's it. Recall that you have the option to do this with mental labels or to do it with direct awareness, just tracking without intentionally labeling, and you can switch back and forth. If you elect to label, the labeling process guarantees a base level of mindful awareness. The pacing of the labels, not too fast, not too slow, guarantees a continuity of concentration. The wording of the labels, accurately identifying the modality you're focusing on, guarantees a base level of sensory clarity. And the voice tone, the mental voice tone that you use, sort of low, gentle, matter of fact, almost impersonal. See, feel. That voice tone is an equanimity tone. You can create it intentionally. And it tends to induce a gentle, matter-of-fact relationship with whatever comes up. In other words, it induces equanimity. So the pacing, the wording, and the tone of the mental labels are actually factors that assure that you have enough mindful awareness. As humans, we have two potential dimensions of happiness. Happiness dependent on conditions, and happiness independent of conditions. Happiness dependent on conditions means the body's comfortable and the mind has answers. Nothing wrong with that. Happiness independent of conditions is measured by something else. The degree to which we can have complete sensory experience of body, mind, and world. Mindfulness training gradually moves us in the direction of complete experience. Complete experience is paradoxical. We're so fully present that we, our mind, our body, and the external senses of sight and sound, we're so fully present that they never constellate into a thing. They're just a wave of expanding, contracting, rich and vibrant space. This training that we're doing is a gradual training of in the ability to completely experience sight, sound, mind, and body. Working with the broadest range, choiceless awareness, open presence, what we just did for the last few minutes. In some ways it's easy. There's no distractions. Whatever comes up is your object of focus. But in other ways it can be challenging because a lot comes up, and until these techniques become second nature, we can have a sense of being flooded. That's the characteristic challenge of the unrestricted range. By way of contrast, if we restrict our focus range in some way, then it's a little easier because not so much to deal with. On the other hand, it's a little harder because now we have to pull away from distraction. Come back to our focus range. It's all good. It's all part of the same skill set: concentration, clarity, equanimity. For the next few minutes, let's let go of the unrestricted range and just work with visual experience. If you wish to label, the label is C, which in this case would stand for mental image. Or if your eyes are open, physical sight in addition to mental image. Or visual rest states. If your eyes are closed, the dark, bright in front of, behind your eyes, eyelids, is a C rest. If your eyes are open, you can defocus, soft focus, that produces a visual rest state. And within the inner activity of image, the outer activity of sight, or the restful state, there may be flow. There may be energy, undulation, pixelation, vibration, expansion, contraction. So you might see in to a mental image, see out to a physical sight, see rest of one form or another, see flow, or some combination or subdivision thereof. It's all visual. Stay with visual experience. If you get pulled into auditory or somatic, come back to visual. Remember, auditory or somatic may influence visual. You hear a sound, you see a mental image. You have a body sensation, once again, maybe you see an image of that body part. Or maybe as body arises, it sort of sucks energy away from the visual field, causing it to thin out and flow, etc. For just a few minutes, with your eyes closed, partially open or fully open, whatever you want, just see. Okay, good. Now, just hear. External sound, mental talk, try to listen with detachment. It might vanish, it might last. There can be restful states, mental quiet, physical silence. There can be a background hum of energy, auditory energy around you. If the surface mental talk goes away, there can be an undercurrent of subtle stirring. These would be auditory flow states. We'll call mental talk inner activation. We'll call physical sound outer activation. We'll call mental quiet or physical silence auditory rest. And within the inner or outer active or restful aspects, there can be flow or not. It's all good, it's all natural. For the next few minutes, our job will be to focus on auditory. The label is here, if you wish to label. Let visual and somatic be in the background. As you anchor in the auditory for a little while. Inevitably, challenges arise. One can have physical discomfort, or there can be sleepiness, and so forth. Feel free anytime you wish to stand in place. That can help relieve physical discomfort, and it can also help us remain more alert. The standing posture is absolutely traditional and legitimate, both in Buddhism and in Jainism, which is another movement from India. Some of our sits will be a little bit long, so you can always just stand in place to help either with sleepiness or discomfort and such. As long as you do so silently, it's even okay to move around a little bit, but once again, slowly, silently, so that the physical distress is not overwhelming. Work smart, push to a manageable degree. Okay, good. Now let go of that auditory focus, and let's restrict our focus range to body. Just feel. It could be the pure physicality of the body, the touch of the air, the touch of the clothes, the impact of the posture, the ongoing physiology of breath and pulse, itches and aches, pressures and pains, stomach's empty, bladder's full, sleepy sensations. These are the physicality of the body. The body, upon occasion, can also have emotionality. Distinctive locations and flavors associated with the major emotions, anger, fear, sadness, embarrassment, impatience, disgust. On the uncomfortable side, interest, joy, love, gratitude, humor, smile. On the pleasant side, the emotionality of the body, which may or may not be present at a given instant. There's the restfulness of the body, physical relaxation, emotional peace. There's the energy flow of the body. Undulation, vibration, scintillation, pixelation, bubbliness, expansive, contractive, waviness, and such. Or the body may be quite stable, without flow. It's all natural, it's all good. For the next few minutes, our focus range will be just feel. Some body states are pleasant. Some are unpleasant. Some are a mixture of both. Some are not particularly either, just neutral. Try to let pleasant and unpleasant come and go without craving or aversion. The old ordering principle, which is valid, is get comfortable. The new ordering principle that we're training is get complete. Whatever the sensation is, try to be as complete with it in the moment as possible, which simply means that completeness is measured by the degree to which you bring concentration, clarity, and equanimity to that body event. Taken to the limit, this relationship causes ordinary experience to become extraordinary, both rich and vacuous at exactly the same time. Gradually, 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 we train ourselves in that direction. Right now, the step is, for the next few minutes, just feel. Let visual and auditory arise in the background, but in the foreground, keep coming back to body. Remember, if discomfort becomes too much, or you have sleepiness, fuzziness, and such, you're invited to stand in place anytime you want. You don't have to wait for the bell or an instruction. You settle into the standing the same way you settle into the seated. It's a traditional valid posture. Okay, good. Now look back. We explored four focus ranges. One was unrestricted, a sort of see, hear, feel everything. Then we did just see, then just hear, then just feel. We sort of scrolled through the modalities in a standard order. In a moment, we're going to be continuing with formal practice, but we're going to transition from practice in stillness to practice in motion. Meaning that we're going to move around, stretch, walk as we can within this small area, use the washrooms, get refreshments, and so forth. However, we will be maintaining a formal noting technique. Decide how you would like to do that period of practice in motion. It'll last maybe 20 minutes or so. Maybe you want to do unrestricted, see, hear, feel everything, or just explore see, or just hear, or just feel. Make a decision based on interest, opportunity, not driven by craving, aversion, or unconsciousness, and no big deal. It all develops the same skill set. Now, open your eyes and implement that technique. We'll be moving around, so we need eyes open practice. And gradually transition, seamless transition to implementing the noting while we're moving. And then when you hear the bell in about 20 minutes or so, we'll come back to seated practice. And once again, seamless transition, continue with the technique for a few minutes. And then we'll transition to a discussion period. So obviously in silence, you can move at normal pace or more rapidly or slowly, whatever appeals to you. Okay, good. So I wanted to mention a couple of themes that can come up when you do the kinds of technique that we've been doing so far in this workshop. So one of the themes is that you get more and more interested in detail and detecting richness and subtlety. That's one possible theme. As you'll remember, the way we've got it set up, I made this big deal about, hey, there's what's required and there's what's allowed. So all that's required to do the technique perfectly is to know moment by moment, I'm focusing on visual, auditory, somatic, if you're doing broadly, or if you're restricting to just one of those ranges to know, okay, moment by moment, I'm in contact with just the visual, just the auditory, whatever it may be. So in terms of detail of clarity or amount of clarity, the only required level is that, okay, I'm aware which modality I'm noting right now. Now, what's allowed is you might get interested in a lot more information than that. If it's auditory, for example, you may not label the distinction, but you will be aware, is it mental talk? Is it external sound? Is it an auditory restful state? And so forth. These are qualitative distinctions. You may also have spatial distinctions. If it's a mental image, you may know the image is in front of my eyes, or the image is projected back where my body is. It's a body image. Or the image is of ambient sound. It's triggered by some sound outside and it's projected out into my surroundings. So you might be aware of spatial information. You might be aware of intensity level. If it's a body sensation, is it subtle? Is it medium? Is it intense? Is it local? Or does it affect the whole body? Or does it have a local global structure, a local splash with a global ripple? You might be aware of that kind of detail. You might be aware whether the sensory event is stable or whether it's flowing, etc., etc. So one theme that might develop, one direction is you get more and more interested in fascinated, enchanted with detecting more and more detail and richness. The labels, if you even elect a label, they'll always be just simple. They'll be your basic level of clarity. But you're certainly allowed, if you wish, if that gets interesting to you, to be aware of all of this kind of detail in each act of noting. That's one possible direction or theme that may present itself. However, an opposite theme might present itself. you might sort of lose interest in detail. Everything sort of gets integrated into a pattern of arising and passing. And yeah, you're keeping track. Is it visual, auditory, somatic? But you sort of don't care. Is it inner, outer? Maybe at some point, if it's body, you don't even care if it's pleasant or unpleasant. Everything sort of simplifies into a pattern of arising, passing, arising, passing. And sort of that's another theme that might present itself, as opposed to getting fascinated with differentiation. You might be drawn into the direction of integration, simplification. Things sort of become uniform. Either of those sort of tendencies is completely valid. One isn't better than the other. There is a third possibility. Neither of those tendencies present themselves. You're just sort of doing the technique as per the instruction. There's no particular draw to find detail. There's no particular draw to ignore detail and find uniformity and integration. It's just you're sort of doing the technique as per instructed. Neither of the themes of differentiation nor integration present themselves. Any of those three scenarios is perfectly valid. But you're going to probably fall into one of those three scenarios. and then just go with it, and it's all good. It's all part of the process. So I just wanted to mention that. Often people are concerned with some way to monitor their success with the practice. How do I know if this is working, etc., etc.? The typical types of things that people initially think about to judge how the practice is working is, well, what kind of experience do I have on the cushion while I'm practicing? Did I get calm? Was there energy? Did I feel emotionally good? Could I taste a state of concentration or clarity or equanimity? You'll remember I mentioned these six things as possible reward flavors that could be present as you're practicing or after a period of practice. Now, it is certainly the case if any of those types of reward flavors, that's what I call them in my own private language, if those happen to be present during or after practice, hey, great, tune into them, enjoy them, you got a positive reinforcement, an immediate Skinnerian hedonic reward, if you're familiar with sort of behaviorist concepts. We're sort of laughing, but actually behaviorism has a lot of relevance to mindfulness practice. It really is an operant conditioning. The Buddha was called Anuttaro Purisa Dhammasarati, which in Pali means the unexcelled trainer of the animal within the human. Not animal in the sense of pejorative, oh, you're some sort of primitive animal, but actually animal in the evolutionary architecture of the brain, that this training goes down right to the reptilian brain, actually right to the spinal cord. All the architectural Darwinian levels of evolution that we have within our central nervous system, the training soaks down, and those deeper levels are Skinnerian conditioning. They're operant conditioning. Basically, the depths of the being learn that when they interfere with themselves, you suffer. And that message then retrains. So if you get these kinds of reward flavors, good, that's fine. Enjoy them, let them reinforce the practice. However, they are not the central criterion for success with this practice in the way that, at least in the way that I would formulate the criteria. So some of you may have heard me say this at lunch, but I wanted to repeat it for the whole group. Here's what I look for. I've got what I call the five apps, okay? An app means an application. Meaning, what do we use mindfulness for? How do we parse the goals of mindfulness practice into independent dimensions? So there's a lot of ways to do that. An intuitive and fairly easy one is there's these five apps. So this is not something you necessarily experience during formal practice on the cushion. It's ordinary life. As you're going about daily life, you can ask yourself, as the result of this practice, does it seem like my general level of physical and emotional suffering is going down? I distinguish discomfort from suffering. Suffering comes about when you're unable to have a complete, that is to say, a fully mindful experience of discomfort. Then it turns into suffering. If you're able to have a fully mindful experience of discomfort, does it hurt? Yes. Is that a problem? No. Is that sort of paradoxical and weird sounding? Yes, but that's just the way it works. So if you are noticing reduction of your general level of suffering, even though your level of discomfort might be the same, if you're noticing reduction of suffering in ordinary life, and if that's moving along fast enough, that's a sign your practice is working. Whatever your experience may be on the cushion, which may just be sleepiness and wandering and confusion, but you notice, hey, daily life is changing. Another app, elevation of sensual fulfillment. You find that the pleasures of life are delivering more satisfaction. So just like I distinguish, well, suffering comes about through incomplete discomfort. Non-fulfillment comes about through incomplete pleasure, or conversely, as your ability to be habitually mindful in the pleasures of life, some of which are sort of subtle, your level of sensory satisfaction or fulfillment in daily life, it will elevate. If you notice that that's happening, you're more sensorially fulfilled, and if that seems to be moving along fast enough, your practice is working. Understanding yourself at all levels, that's app number three, not just the personal psychological level, which has its place, but actually it's the specialty of psychology to help you there. Okay, mindfulness can help you there, but it's not the specialty. The specialty of mindfulness is to help you contact the deeper transpersonal level. Ultimately, hopefully the deepest level, which we call enlightenment. So understanding yourself at progressively deeper levels, if that self-understanding seems to be there in daily life, improving, you notice change and it's fast enough for you, your practice is working. Positive behavior changes, either cultivated or spontaneous, shila we call it, which is often translated as precepts, but I prefer the translation character. If you're noticing that there are in your objective behaviors, how you carry yourself socially, what you say, what you do, the kind of feedback that people give you as to what kind of person you are, if there seems to be improvement in behavior, as I say, either intentionally cultivated or just spontaneous, that's a sign your practice is working. Last but certainly not least, if, once again, either spontaneous or cultivated, you're noticing a spirit of love and service towards others, technical term in Mahayana Buddhism, bodhicitta. So bodhicittuppada, cittuppada, the arising of this sort of, hey, it's not just, this practice isn't just about me, you know, getting more comfortable, it's also about how do I reach out and bring all of those other goodies to others, elevate their fulfillment, reduce their suffering, and so forth. So that's a fifth app, so to speak. If you're noticing any one or combination of these in daily life, and it can in some way be ascribed to the practice, and it's moving along fast enough for you, your practice is working. It doesn't matter what technique you're doing. It even doesn't matter what your experience on the cushion is. If you can say yes to one or more of these, those are the criteria that I use. Those are the things I query when people come to me and want some sort of big picture guidance with their practice. I just go down that list of apps and see which ones are happening and which ones aren't happening. And then for the ones that aren't happening, okay, maybe we need to modify the practice, or maybe we just need to wait a little while, and so forth. So I just wanted to share that with you, because as I say, the general tendency is, oh, I'm having this or that experience while I'm practicing, so I'm getting it, I'm not getting it, it's working, it's not working. But I prefer actually not so much to look at the experience during formal practice, but more at this sort of impact in daily life. So I wanted to share that. In a moment, we're going to open it up for you folks to ask your questions. But I had one more point I wanted to make. During the guidance, I said something that was actually pretty weird. Something that I probably said a bunch of things that were pretty weird. I mean, relative to, a fly on the wall, if someone comes from the outside that isn't familiar with what we do, it all probably sounds pretty freaking weird. But in any event, the particularly weird thing I said, the kind of thing that if I had heard it 50 years ago, I did hear it 50 years ago, and I thought it was weird, I thought it was bullshit. but now I'm saying it. It's like, so I said that as your CC&E, your concentration, your clarity, equanimity, that's the way I prefer to define mindful awareness. As your mindful awareness gets sharper and sharper and sharper, your ability to experience the senses completely increases. This is my phraseology. It's just the way I like to talk about it. And there's a certain critical value. I don't know, anyone here ever, anyone here study calculus in school? Just curious. Okay, a few people. So taken to the limit, okay? If you take these, this is once again a little bit of a math joke, okay? If you take in the limit of this, ordinary experience becomes extraordinary. And the way it becomes extraordinary is weird and paradoxical sounding. The only way I can put it is you're so busy experiencing that there's no time to coagulate the experience into a thing. So it is simultaneously enormously rich and transparent and vacuous. There's a great phrase in Tibetan, Detong Yerme, the oneness of bliss and void. it's like, what? The oneness of bliss and void. Well, it's weird sounding, but there's a reason they talk about that or talk in that language. If you read the great poem by the Christian mystic San Juan de la Cruz, St. John of the Cross, called La Noche Oscura, The Dark Night, when you're done reading that poem, you will be left with two flavors, two aftertastes. One is a sense of utter bleakness and vacuity, and the second is a sense of profound, almost sensual fulfillment. Can hardly even believe the thing was written by a Catholic priest in the 16th century, because basically it's about this girl sneaking out for a midnight, love affair, okay? But it's a metaphor for the soul uniting with God. So it has all of this sensuality to it, but it's also just full with words like nada, nadie, okay, nothing, no one. Nadie parecía, no one could find you. No one could see me, okay? It's like you're left with the taste of emptiness and richness, and that is the taste of complete experience. So that's poetry. Can we in any way make this prosaic? Can we actually give a metaphor for how that comes about? Well, I think we can. So let's go to ordinary English, not the special vocabulary of a philosopher or such. Ordinary English, I would suggest to you that the word real, as philosophers and scientists argue about what's real, we're not going to do that. That's not my specialty. But we're going to look at how the word real is used in ordinary English. Sometimes real is a measure of how vivid a sensory experience is. For example, for me, day-to-day life in India wasn't real, and then I lived there, and after that, it became real. I mean, I saw movies and things, but that's not the same as living day-to-day. You know, it's a whole other world there. If you've ever been, some of you probably have, you know what I'm referring to, okay? So it wasn't real, and then it became real because it became sensorially vivid. So on one hand, we use the word real in ordinary colloquial English as a measure of how sensorially vivid something is. On the other hand, we will sometimes use the word real not so much as a measure of sensory vividness, but as a measure of gripping power or power to make us not be able to look elsewhere. For example, if you get some bad news health diagnosis, suddenly whatever that is real, okay? Hey, this is the real world and your attention can't go anywhere else. Or you get some bad news financial, you know, you leave the retreat and you discover the IRS has taken your money away, or your house has been robbed, or, okay, it's like, this is real, okay? Attention ain't going anywhere else. Or you're betrayed, or you betray, or, you know, any one of a gazillion things. Oh, this is real, as a measure of gripping power. So now, let's take some very ordinary experience. Let's take the experience of walking. And we're going to simplify the paradigm. We're going to say that you're going to take one step per second. And you have a goal to be mindful of walking. Your goal is, in other words, put in another language, to have as complete a sensory experience as possible of the act of walking. So we're going to create a sequence of progressively greater sensory clarity. In terms of baud rate, what's baud rate mean? B-A-U-D. Yes, bandwidth. It's actually, though, a temporal measure. It's how much information per unit time is coming through, how many bits per second or bytes per minute, etc., etc. Baud is one of the measures of information per unit time. So let's say that each time you take a step, it requires a second, and our first approximation of completeness or mindfulness, using those as synonyms, is we're clearly aware left, right, left, right. So in the second it takes me to pace the left, I know it's left. And the second it takes me to pace the right, I know it's right. So how many pieces of information are coming in per second? One piece per second, right? It's left versus right. Now let's say that we're going to refine this a bit. I am going to be clearly aware of the lift, the swing, and the tread on each side. So there's a clear awareness when lifting, swinging, treading. And in fact, sometimes they'll even have you label that in the Mahasi tradition, lift, swing, tread, and so forth. So now, at that scale, how many clear pieces of information per second? I'm going to say three, the lift, the swing, and the tread. Now you might say, yes, and simultaneously, you know it's right versus left. We could do the math like that, but we're going to just go down into the scales. So now let's say, just to simplify the math a little bit. So now let's say that you're aware of the beginning, middle, and end of the lift. Clearly, the beginning, middle, and end of the swing, the beginning, middle, and end of the tread. Just at that scale, how many clear pieces of information per second? Nine. Now, can the human nervous system resolve further? Yes. Resolve is a technical term. Resolve means separate. Separate things that will tend to fall together. Vipassana, V as a prefix in Sanskrit and Pali, means apart. And pasati in Pali or pashati in Sanskrit means to see, but more broadly, to detect. So one meaning, there are others, meanings of the word vipassana or vipassana is resolution, discernment, the ability to separate things that would tend to fall together. A high-res screen allows you to have more separation detail. Okay, so resolution. Can the human nervous system resolve events faster than nine clear pieces per second? Yeah, it can. Let's say that in the beginning of each lift, the beginning itself, you can distinguish three little muscle groups, okay? And in the middle part, another three, okay? We're simplifying the math, obviously, just to make a point. So let's say now you had nine before, and now there's everything is multiplied by three, so now how much do we have? 27, right? Now, someplace between 27 and 81 clear pieces of information per second, you reach the, saturate the information channel for conscious processing for a human being, I'm guessing. I don't know if we have really hard data on this, but hey, ballpark is fine, because I'm just, you know, I could be off by an order of magnitude or two, but I want you to get the general idea here. There comes a time. So let's look at our sequence, okay? 1, 3, 9, 27, maybe 81, okay? So clearly, if we use the word real, once again, not in its philosophical or scientific sense, which is highly contentious, but in its colloquial sense, if we say real, I'm having a real experience of walking, and it measures vividness, then clearly this sequence is showing greater and greater vividness. And at some point, you reach, it's quite finite mathematically, but because it saturates the information channel, it's effectively infinite. It's as much as can be in terms of richness or detail or resolution. So that's one sequence. Let's look at another sequence. If I have to be clearly aware of a change every second, then what's the longest I can hold on to one piece of information without it starting to interfere with my next process? 1 second. If I have to be aware of something new every third of a second, what's the longest I can fixate any part of my awareness? Well, 1/3 of a second, right? Because I can't, if I hold beyond 1/3 of a second, I'm not going to be Johnny on the spot for the next arising, okay? Now look at this. So at the next step, where you're detecting nine pieces per second, the longest you can hold on is 1/9. At the next step, 1/27 of a second. At the next step, 1/81 of a second. Now, someplace I'm guessing between 1/27 of a second and 1/81 of a second, you are effectively not holding on to anything at all. Nothing actually gets coagulated. Nothing actually lasts as a thing. So right at the point when it is maximally rich and maximally real in our first sense of the word real, its gripping power drops to effectively zero, and it's sort of not there anymore as a thing. That's the point of complete experience. That's the point at which all you can say is, it's as rich and fulfilling as anything could be, and it's not really there as a thing anymore. Doing that with walking could take a while. How about doing that with the arising of the sense of self? That is a much more complex sensory event, but it is a sensory event. Now, in traditional Buddhism, there are various ways to untangle the strands of self. The canonical one, the sort of classic one, is the five aggregates, the five skandhas. You can look it up on Wikipedia, see if you can figure out what it means. It's pretty inscrutable, to be honest. The translations of the different elements in English don't seem to have anything to do with each other. If you look at the different ways people are very little to do with each other, it's pretty hard to follow, although you can get a sort of general idea. But I think what's important is the general idea. The general idea is that there are elements, and when you untangle them, the somethingness of self goes away. Another possible way to cut up the pie is the so-called four foundations of mindfulness. Yeah, another way is the four great elements, earth, water, air, fire. That appears, particularly with the sense of the thingness of the body self. there's this stunning passage, you can hardly believe this is in Buddhist literature, but it's probably authentic, probably good. You do understand not everything in Buddhist literature was spoken by the Buddha, right? I hope you do understand that. It was written down centuries later. Scholars argue as to what may or may not have been things he actually said, Buddha Vachana. Buddha Vachana means things we're confident the historical Buddha actually said. But in any event, this might be an authentic passage. There's a place where he says, and I quote, "Just as a skillful butcher would in the marketplace carve up a cow, and the impression at some point the impression cow goes away and the impression meat arises, so in the same way the skillful meditator carves up the experience of body self into earth, water, air, into these elements. And at some point, the perception body goes away, and the perception earth, water, air, and fire arises." It's primitive chemistry. But you can see the general method here. The general method is wherever you're identified, break it up into its pieces, resolve those pieces, pull them apart, untangle them, and that sense of sakkaya ditti, this is the key word in Pali, sakkaya ditti, sakkayadittihi with dots under the t's. Can you say it? Sakkaya ditti. There's two k's and two t's. Sakkaya ditti, and the t's are retroflex. This kind of sound, okay? Sakkaya ditti. okay, so what that means is the perception that there is a thing inside me called the self. That's the main thing that goes away at sota apatti, or stream entry, aka initial enlightenment. So, okay. So the basic idea is that's what you do. So, because of my training in science and mathematics, I always like to generalize things, and if possible, I like to simplify things. Occam's razor. So let's take a simpler paradigm. This is the one I typically use. It seems to work pretty well, actually. The core subjective I am-ness. How does it arise sensorially? Well, we can do an experiment. Let's do an experiment. Let's listen to sound. Same music. So you put on some music, and you listen to the music. But your interest is in investigating, tangibly speaking, how does this perception, there's a me over here listening to the music over there, arise? Tangibly. Obviously, there's the music. That's one thing. But how about this sense of a listener to the music? The sakkaya ditti, there's a me over here separate from and listening to the music over there. How does that arise? Well, here's one experiment you can do. You can use see, hear, feel, but just restrict it to your inner world. So at any given instant, the music may trigger a mental image or not. At any given instant, the music may trigger a mental comment in talk space or not. At any given instant, the music may trigger an emotional reaction in your body or not. How many possibilities have I described? Now, before you jump to an answer, listen carefully to what I said, okay? With regards to see in, inner see, the mental image, it might be there or it might not be there. How many possibilities is that? That's two, right? For each of those possibilities, at that same moment, mental talk might be there or not. How many total possibilities now? Four. The original two, and for each of those two, there's two, right? So it's a tree, exponential. Now, for each of those four possibilities, at that same instant, the emotional body might be activated or not. How many total possibilities now? Eight. Two times two times two, two to the third power, eight. If you're interested in this, which would be cool if you were, but most people could give a rat's ass, but if you are interested, look up Pascal's triangle. That's what Europeans and Americans call it, but in China, it's called Zhu Shijie's triangle because he discovered it hundreds of years before Pascal in China. But in India, it's called Pingala's triangle because Pingala discovered it hundreds of years before Zhu Shijie in China. It really needs to be called Pingala's triangle. And the Wikipedia gives credit where credit is due. So it's combinatorial mathematics, which, like I say, most people could care less about. However, it's not entirely irrelevant to getting a clear idea of how we come to one way to come to enlightenment and no self. It's only one way. It's only one out of many ways. But in this particular analysis, which appeals to scientists because they can see the experimental design and implement it, anyone can implement it, your inner reactive state to the outer sound at any given instant has exactly eight possibilities. At the most extreme activation, you could have mental image, mental talk, and the emotional body all erupting at the same time, or more or less the same time. That's an all situation. At the other extreme, it could happen that there's just the sound. Doesn't trigger any surface or deep image activity, doesn't trigger any surface or deep talk activity, doesn't trigger any conscious or subliminal emotional sensations whatsoever. And then in between, there's all these sort of in-between states. What you'll notice is that if you get a full eruption of that inner system, it is likely that your sense of a self listening to an it called sound will be strong. However, if spontaneously you get that other extreme where there's just the sound and that inner system doesn't activate, you'll discover amazingly that you have no perception of self whatsoever. And there's no separation between the sound. You are the sound. Because there's, for a moment, the inner system went offline and it's no longer imprisoning you. So your identity now becomes fluid. You can call it no self, or you can call it true self, elastic self, whatever you want to call it. Anyone can do this experiment. It's very clearly defined. You do have to train yourself in the ability to detect inner, see, hear, feel combos. But if you do this experiment, you will notice a wide fluctuation in the sense of I'm a thing listening to it-ness. So then is the secret to turn off the inner system? Is that what we mean by enlightenment? Well, actually, no. That will give you what I just described is just the beginning of the experiment. However, it already is hugely heuristic. Okay, I'm sorry. I can't resist using that word. Heuristic means leading to eureka. Eureka. Aha! Oh my God. The self comes and goes like a wave. Sometimes it intensifies and it's really there. Sometimes it's like not even there at all. If you constrain yourself to observe with these categories, you cannot not see that with time. And that's an oh my God. That's a real eureka. Eureka. But that's just the beginning of the experiment, because what we're really looking at is something more. That would be very, what I've just described is enormously liberating, but probably won't constitute stream entry. The next thing, well, that's a different thing. So what's the next thing? So now we've divided the selfhood into these clearly definable, clearly observable, tangible, spatially distributed sensory events. That's why I like this paradigm. It's all sensory. and therefore, someday, we'll be able to ferret out the neural correlates of what I'm now describing. Not there yet, but we're starting. If you go online, put Shinzen Young, Harvard University, you'll see some articles about a piece of research I designed that is an ongoing project at Harvard Medical School, where we're actually looking for the fMRI correlates of what I'm describing to you. Eventually, that's what we hope to get to. We're just making the beginning of the beginning of the beginning. This is a very difficult research protocol, and it will probably take decades. But we've started, and it's funded, and we're doing it, and it's one of the best research facilities on the planet, so pretty exciting, actually, but that's a whole other thing. okay, so what's the next step? Well, now that we've separated out the elements, we have to treat each one of those elements like we treated the walking. We have to get to the point where we're so fully present with each arising of mental image, each arising of mental talk, each arising of emotional body, so fully present that it is absent. And we are absent. Now at that point, we're developing the ability to have a complete experience of the arising of the reactive, subjective self. And it's at that point that a paradigm shift can occur that will change you forever. And even though that system may come online very strongly, you'll never really believe that it is a thing called the self. So it's much more difficult. I mean, it's difficult enough to be so fully present in the act of walking that walking is no longer an object. That alone is hugely challenging. But to be so fully present in the arising of the full Monty of I am-ness. That's a lot of training. And you might say, well, who's doing the observing then? The habit of observing is doing the observing at that point. there's no observer. So that's one way, and there are many other ways. This is called the arising of the self. This could be the full Monty. This could be your chance right here. That's the emotional sensation in the body, okay. There's the, oh my God, I'm the one in talk space. There's the image of all of these people looking at you and laughing at you. Now, can you have a complete experience of this? If you can, then I say, get up here and take over. I think you're doing pretty good. I think you're doing pretty good because you do have the habit of observing for a long, long time, I know. So congratulations. okay, so now that's the end of my blabbering. And we got a few minutes for any questions that you might have or things you'd like to bring up. Yes, and I think we're going to circulate a mic. That's not the only way to get enlightened, by the way. There's a bunch of them. It's just the one I like.
So I guess, you know, there's been a lot of how, and, you know, I'm also interested in the why, but I guess for the purposes of this one question and it being concise, I'll just go with, as a New Yorker who's choosing to live here in Manhattan and having to subsist, what would the practice look like until I can get off to a retreat and how long those retreats would be or whatever have you, but what would the practice look like in terms of, is it 45 minutes in the morning at best, or, you know, just how would the...
Yes, I can definitely address that, and that's a really good question to ask. First, I would say, I actually once at lunch and now again to everyone, gave one way of talking about the why, okay? Those five apps I mentioned, those are the why, okay? You know, those constitute human happiness. So the quick answer is happiness and success. That's why. And you can break it down into less suffering, more fulfillment, behavior, not self-knowledge, love and service, etc. That actually answers why. You're asking actually another facet of how, which is, how do I organize my practice? So I'm going to give a soundbite answer, and then I'm going to give a little more than a soundbite, but not a whole lot more. So the soundbite answer to how to organize your practice in terms of how much, you know, when, where, that kind of thing, I've got an article on the internet. You can find it at basicmindfulness.org, and it's probably been copied by other people. It's called Outline of Practice, and it's exactly what it is. It's an outline of practice. It says, hey, these are the ducks. Here's the parameters. Line this up. You have a good possibility of success. So that's the soundbite answer. Carefully read my article, Outline of Practice. Now the sort of a little bit longer answer is... I distinguish formal practice from practice in life. So you want to have both. And I can give you some idea of what I mean by those terms and what the amounts would be. That would be minimums, sort of, quote, mandatory minimums, okay? okay, so formal practice means the period lasts for at least 10 minutes and you have a 100% commitment to implementing the technique, okay? Formal practice can be done in stillness, you're seated, or it can be done while moving. We've done both at this program. So you want to do, on most days, if possible, 10 minutes of formal practice in stillness, 10 minutes of formal practice in motion, as a sort of minimum, most days. If you can't do that, okay, it's not the end of the world, but that's a minimum. A lot of people put in a half hour or even more, but I would say minimum, you know, 10 minutes of formal practice. And if you can do 10 on stillness and 10 on motion, that's good. Because practice in motion is very related to being able to carry the practice into daily life. Your eyes are open, you're walking, etc. So that's formal practice. Then there's what I call practice in life. And I divide practice in life into two kinds of practices. This is just my own private language, my own jargon. I call them micro hits and background practice. So micro hit is 30 seconds here, 3 minutes there, as you're walking to the washroom or as someone is talking to you and it's a vacuous, meaningless conversation that doesn't require more than 10% of your CPU, you're implementing a technique, a formal technique, but it's not like 10 minutes worth of technique, okay? It's just a micro hit. I have people, you know, probably a lot of you are very busy. They have to walk from this conference room to that conference room. It's a minute. But every day when they walk to that conference room, I ask them for that minute, start on a dime. Start your technique on a dime. See, feel, see, feel, feel, hear. You notice that I did not have to sit for a half hour anchoring myself in my breath in order to be able to be mindful. Feel, see. I can even do it while I'm talking to you. See. See, I'm seeing out, then I saw a mental image. I'm tracking all that while I'm talking to you, okay? You train yourself, I call it start on a dime. You force yourself, even though you're guessing or you're not sure, you just start doing it right in the middle of daily life. I call that a micro hit. You do it when you don't need all of your attention for something else. And you try to do at least a half dozen of those each day. Every person has a half dozen, 30 second here, 3 minute there, where they don't need to do it, you know, they can implement a quick hit. Then background practice is, well, you're not fully committed to doing the practice, but you sort of have it going in the background. Like what some of you have been doing while I've been talking. Some of you have been sort of having the practice continuing in the background. It's not like full committed formal practice with your eyes closed in an asana, although I don't mind if you do that while I talk. I call that background practice. So you want to do a little of that also, and that's described in there. Then the other rhythm that you want is retreats. If at all possible, minimum, do one-week residential retreat per year. This is a two-day non-residential retreat, what we just did, okay? Residential means you go to the place, you get up at 5 in the morning, you go to bed at 10 at night, and you're just meditating all day, not necessarily sitting all day, but sort of unbroken practice, and it's, say, a week or 5 days or 10 days with Mr. Goenka, for example. You do one residential retreat per year, if possible. Problem is, that's not possible for a lot of people. So the way I say it then is do one residential retreat per year or equivalent. So what's an equivalent? Well, let's say that you did a one-day retreat once a month. I would say that's roughly equivalent to a residential retreat. A lot of people can't do that. In fact, most people can't do that. Well, good news, there's another thing you can do. I mentioned yesterday, if you go to basicmindfulness.org, you'll find a description of the, quote, home practice program. Home practice program is my creative solution to how we can bring retreat practice to everyone in the world. Because most people in the world don't live in a situation where they can even do one-day retreats. In terms of where they live and their familial and job responsibilities and social situation don't allow them to get away for even, leave their house for even a weekend. So what we do is we create a weekend of retreat modules that last from 2 to 4 hours long. If you do all the modules, you will have done a Friday through Sunday weekend retreat. If you just do one module, say 4 hours, you will have done a micro retreat. If you participate in the home practice program each month, and you don't need to leave your house to do it, it's conference call based. You register online, we send you a telephone number, you call it. We have given you preparation, although actually at this point you know everything you need to know about, well, most of what you need to know to participate. It can be as short as 2 or 4 hours or as long as the whole weekend. You don't have to leave your family. You just say, okay, I'm going to go in this room and be on this telephone for 4 hours, and then I'm going to be back. If you do that on a monthly basis, that will count as the equivalent of a one residential retreat. And that is doable by anyone in the world, and the cost is almost nothing, or is nothing. If you can't afford it, we'll just let you do it for free forever. So another way to get your retreats in, if it's, you know, you can't really leave the house so much, for you or people you know, is, okay, send them to basicmindfulness.org, and we'll bring the retreats to you in a... So, but you need retreat practice in addition to day-to-day practice. Basically, it's at retreats, and this is sort of a mini retreat, what we just did here. At retreats, you tend to go to a new level. Then you back it up with your day-to-day practice, and it doesn't become a peak. It becomes a plateau that you then slowly build on, and then you have your next spurt forward will tend to come at your next retreat. These are statistical tendencies. I mean, sometimes it doesn't work that way. But this tends to give you a sort of stepwise growth curve over the years. But if you look over the decades, it's going to have an exponential envelope to it, meaning it's not going to be a linear growth. At some point, it goes hockey stick. And that's when the prospects of, like, little old me actually experiencing the stuff I read about in the books, that actually becomes a palpable visage for you. Maybe 5 months down the line, maybe 5 years down the line, hey, maybe 15 years down the line, depending, but we're living householders' lives. We're not monastics, so we have to amortize our ego death over a longer period of time. So, retreats combined with the day-to-day. And those are sort of the minimums that I would recommend. Line that up, you have a pretty good, I'm not going to guarantee enlightenment. I will say very high probability you will not regret having done that. So that was a good question. I think we have time for one more in the back. Well, a mic's coming. I pointed to the, sorry, I don't even know your name. Yep.
Hi. So in terms of non-monastic kind of everyday life, is there an upper threshold to how much you would recommend practicing? Is there a point where without the kind of structure of a community, it can be potentially dangerous?
Okay, well, potentially dangerous.
Maybe that's too strong.
The biggest danger in this practice is not doing the practice. that's where most people fall off, okay? They substitute arguing about the maps for making the journey. The next biggest danger is not that, you know, that you're gonna go into the white light and your umbilicus gets severed and you float off and, you know. Those are not really dangers, okay? The second biggest danger is nothing dramatic like that. It's getting caught in a good place. You come to a good place with your practice and you sort of stagnate there. So the dangers are basically you don't do the practice, or if you do the practice, you get caught at a good place. Is there a theoretical situation where someone is doing too much practice? yes, that could theoretically happen. However, that's pretty specialized, and it's much more likely that it's going to be one of the other two things that becomes problematic. Too much practice is, well, the practice is bringing up too much too soon, and you're getting feedback from people that the more you practice, the more insufferable you'll be coming. That's a big red flag, okay? But, you know, that's unlikely. I did leave out one of the ducks that you need to line up. And it addresses the issue that you just brought up. Your chances of success become much higher if you have at least one competent coach that is guiding the big picture of your practice. Competent coach means someone with a track record in achieving the goals that you want to achieve. Someone who has a track record in doing that with students consistently, that's a competent coach. I'm not a big believer in finding the perfect guru that walks on lotuses and has impeccable teachings. I think that's a myth. It just doesn't even exist. But there is a range of competencies in terms of the ability to guide people to certain experiences. And if you want those experiences, you want to go with someone that has a track record in bringing people to that. Now, you might not want those experiences. You might want just a little stress relief or a little concentration. There's hundreds of teachers that can do that. If you want stream entry in the classic mode, well, that's a little different story. So having at least one competent coach that you touch base with on the big picture of your practice, and they'll determine if you're under or over practicing. They'll help you with that. I usually encourage a once a year contact. Typically, that takes place at retreats. You get an interview with someone. And at the home practice program, what I do is, even though they're mostly 4-hour modules, there's a 1-hour block or a 90-minute block, actually, typically, where you're practicing on your own. You can call me on the phone. Or if it's a facilitator, you can call them and talk. We can't talk for long because there's 60 people and maybe a tenth of them are going to call me. But we may have 10 minutes to, and believe me, I've got an algorithm. I know the questions to ask, and I can quickly do. If you ever saw that show, House MD, well, I'm not a sociopath or a curmudgeon, but I am good at differential diagnosis. So I just ask you a bunch of questions. In about 10 minutes, I can usually figure out where you're at. Often, the answer is, hey, it ain't broke. You don't have to fix it. It's just working perfectly. So I would strongly encourage you to get a competent coach, at least one. I don't think it has to be an exclusive, but anyway, that sort of takes care of, you know, the big picture, someone to sort of shepherd you towards your goals. Now, your goals don't have to be classical enlightenment or anything. Goals can be whatever you want, just pain management or anger management. That's the beauty of mindfulness. It's one approach fits all. All the different levels of motivation. So, okay, we will now be motivated in just a moment to have mindful lunch. Once again, an hour and 15 minutes. We'll be back here, eat light. I'm going to do what I did yesterday, which is eat out there and very open to people talking to me while I do that. If you don't mind my stuffing my face while you bare your soul, talking to me while I do that, if you don't mind my stuffing my face while you bare your soul.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.